Chapter 23 Dirty Boots. During Lincoln's stay at City Point, Phil Sheridan and his hard-charging cavalry rode in with many jaded, even shoeless, horses, exhausted from operations on muddy plains in ceaseless rain. Grant knew it would take several days before the animals were freshly shod and replenished. The rangy Lincoln had been agog at the exploits of the doughty little Sheridan. As they shared a boat ride on the James River, the president had stared down at the diminutive general. "General Sheridan, when this peculiar war began, I thought a cavalryman should be at least 6 feet 4 inches high, but I have changed my mind. 5 feet 4 will do in a pinch." Grant issued written instructions for Sheridan to move his cavalry against Lee's right flank, and, if this misfired, to break off, proceed to North Carolina, and assist Sherman to destroy Johnston before circling back to help take Richmond and Petersburg. After absorbing these instructions, a disgruntled Sheridan, who didn't relish a long trek into North Carolina, slunk off in a terrible funk. Sensing his displeasure, Grant drew him aside and confided thoughts he dared not commit to paper. The northern public had grown so eager to end the war, Grant explained, that unless the current Virginia campaign proved an unqualified success, it would be interpreted as a disastrous defeat. For that reason, he had stated, for the record only, that Sheridan might move south. Now Grant elaborated privately, saying he intended to close the war right here, with this movement, and that he should go no farther. Sheridan's face at once brightened up, and slapping his hand on his leg, he said, "I'm glad to hear it, and we can do it." Convinced the war neared its close, Sheridan wanted his cavalry to be in at the death. Several political realities colored Grant's thinking in these waning days of battle. He had already informed Lincoln of his plan to attack Lee's extreme right flank, blocking Lee's ability to aid Johnston, when the roads dried up. Some skeptics wondered why he didn't wait until Sherman finished off Johnston and could then fortify him against Lee. The true motivation was political. For much of the war, Western armies had won the lion's share of acclaim, and Grant, like Sheridan, thought it imperative that the Army of the Potomac claim the main credit for the demise of Lee's army. In that way, each section of the nation would share the final victory laurels, helping to restore post-war unity. The fear of Sherman dashing north and stealing their glory pervaded the Army of the Potomac. Some also suspected Grant didn't want Sherman to upstage him. Not only did Grant show political instincts that matched his military reflexes, but he demonstrated how seriously he meditated the shape of post-war politics. He also knew the war cost a stupendous $4 million a day, and if it persisted, could easily bankrupt the federal government. With 50,000 men lined up behind a creek called Hatcher's Run, Grant prepared for his final campaign, a major offensive southwest of Petersburg. On March 28th, Lee knew something big was afoot. "General Grant is evidently preparing for something," he told his daughter, "and is marshaling and preparing his troops for some movement which is not yet disclosed." The next day, before dawn, riding on boggy roads, Sheridan shifted west around Lee's right with nearly 10,000 cavalry, hoping to knock out two railroads that formed Lee's lifelines. Lee swung his troop strength to the south to confront this massive threat, dispatching George Pickett with 11,000 soldiers to guard a crucial crossroads at Five Forks. "Hold Five Forks at all hazards," Lee instructed him. Bowing to Grant's overwhelming strength, Lee decided to commit everything to a desperate gamble and abandon Petersburg. Reflecting his dire predicament, he admitted to Jefferson Davis that "Grant's move seriously threatens our position and diminishes our ability to maintain our present line." No reasonable alternative existed except to discard the Confederate stronghold on the Appomattox River. With Richmond menaced, Jefferson Davis's wife and children fled, feeding rumors that the capital might be transferred to Georgia. With so much riding on the outcome, Grant paced in a profoundly anxious state, keeping Lincoln minutely informed by telegraph. Never before had he enjoyed such daily, almost hourly, access to the president, signaling that the climactic battle lay just ahead. Grant was haunted by the prospect that Lee and his men might flee to the mountains and fight on in scattered, irregular units, a guerrilla force difficult to run aground. "The general feels like making a heavy push for everything we have hoped for so long, and I am not slow in seconding all such feelings," Rawlins wrote. With everything set for a major advance the next morning, Grant blustered to Sheridan that, "I now feel like ending the matter." Then the skies opened, and heavy rains drenched roads already flooded with standing pools. So many horses and mules were swallowed by quicksand and had to be yanked from thick muck that the army laid down corduroy roads to advance artillery and wagon trains. Writing to Julia amid a heavy downpour on March 30th, Grant allowed himself a witticism, saying it was consoling to know that it rains on the enemy as well. Plunging through sheets of rain, Sheridan galloped to Grant's headquarters, hoping to steal Grant's wavering resolve and lobby for the final thrust against Lee. When he arrived, a pall had settled over the officers in Grant's tent. Supported by Rawlins, Sheridan sought to embolden them. According to Horace Porter, he stalked up and down like a hound in the lash, asserting that, if strengthened by infantry, he could crush Lee's right wing or break through and march into Petersburg. He summed up his stance with a dash of bravado. "I tell you, I'm ready to strike out tomorrow and go to smashing things." Badeau related that Sheridan talked so cheerily, so confidently, so intelligently of what he could do that his mood was contagious, and Grant's low spirits evaporated. "We will go on," he informed Sheridan, ordering him to seize Five Forks. The next day, Grant sent Lincoln a running commentary on the fierce fighting based on dispatches Sheridan transmitted from a spot near Dinwiddie Courthouse. Plagued by heavy rains and horrid roads, Union forces had retreated before two infantry divisions commanded by George Pickett, but Grant was sure Sheridan would retrieve lost ground. He was ecstatic at having coaxed Lee from his fortifications, giving him a fair chance to end the war. He trusted only one general to complete the job, Phil Sheridan, who, with his bottomless courage, seemed heedless of death. "I have never in my life taken a command into battle," Sheridan maintained, "and had not the slightest desire to come out alive unless I won." This encapsulated why Grant reposed such supreme confidence in him. At 10:45 that night, he directed Sheridan, "You will assume command of the whole force sent to operate with you, and use it to the best of your ability to destroy the force which your command has fought so gallantly today." On April 1st, 1865, at Five Forks, came the swift blow from which Robert E. Lee never recovered. The encounter one Southern officer eulogized as the Confederacy's Waterloo. Late in the afternoon, an impatient Sheridan sent his dismounted cavalry crashing into Confederate lines, aided by Governor Warren's corps on his flank. Sheridan was as energetic as a storybook soldier, riding Rienzi up and down the line, shaking his fist at the enemy and inspiring his men with pungent oaths. "The cowardly scoundrels can't fight such brave men as mine," he roared, or "kill that infernal skulker." Porter recorded a horrifying moment when a Union soldier was struck by a bullet in his neck, which spouted blood. "I'm killed," the man exclaimed, slumping to the ground. "You're not hurt a bit," Sheridan expostulated. "Pick up your gun, man, and move right on to the front." So commanding were Sheridan's words that the stricken man hoisted his musket and stumbled forward a dozen paces before keeling over and dropping dead. In another extraordinary moment, Sheridan vaulted on horseback over a Confederate barrier, only to drop down in the middle of astounded enemy soldiers. Pickett's army didn't simply reel under the bluecoats' onslaught, but disintegrated, allowing Sheridan to capture thousands of prisoners, almost half the rebel soldiers, while the other half fled in fright. When Porter rode into Grant's camp with the glad tidings, he found the officers grouped around a blazing campfire, with Grant wrapped in a long blue overcoat and smoking his usual cigar. Not waiting to dismount, Porter shouted the news from horseback to electrifying effect. All the officers except Grant leapt to their feet, shook hands, spun their hats in the air, and engaged in backslapping. Typically, Grant reacted in businesslike fashion, eager to exploit enemy weakness and knowing Lee would now have to abandon Petersburg and Richmond. He disappeared into his tent and scratched out orders to batter the entire Petersburg front at 4:45 the next morning. As ever, he reasoned that because Lee had shored up forces on his left, he must have weakened his center. It represented a huge military gamble, but Grant was eager to move in for the kill. Despite the moment's high drama, he slumbered peacefully on his camp bed that night. As dawn broke and hundreds of Union guns boomed simultaneously, the attack was launched while Grant waited at headquarters. A vast flying wedge of soldiers descended on all points of the Confederate lines. After the grinding misery of a 4-year war, the tempo speeded up in an almost unimaginable manner. Union troops under Generals Ord, Andrew Humphreys, and Horatio Wright stormed Petersburg, slashing openings and taking the outer ring of defenses. As soon as Grant heard of this triumph, he mounted his horse to join the troops who were inside the works. When I arrived there, I rode my horse over the parapet just as Wright's 3,000 prisoners were coming out. When Grant encountered Wright's men, they burst into cheers unlike anything he had ever heard. Once inside Petersburg's fortifications, he dismounted and gazed at the sophisticated ramparts with something akin to awe. "They are exceedingly strong," he told Julia, "and I wonder at the success of our troops carrying them by storm." By his own estimate, he had captured 12,000 prisoners and 50 pieces of artillery from a Southern army once deemed unbeatable. The scene unfolding on the rebel side was a mirror image of such elation. Submitting to the inevitable, Lee ordered his crippled, depleted army to retreat from Petersburg. To save the remnant of this force, he needed to evacuate Richmond as well. As he informed Secretary of War Breckinridge, "I see no prospect of doing more than holding our position here till night. I am not certain that I can do that. If I can, I shall withdraw tonight north of the Appomattox." Late that afternoon, Grant transmitted to Lincoln news of his victory, inviting him to tour the captured Petersburg works the next day. Julia was at City Point with Lincoln when he received the message and noted his radiant expression. "Allow me to tender to you and all with you the nation's grateful thanks for this additional and magnificent success," Lincoln replied to Grant. "At your kind suggestion, I think I will meet you tomorrow." Some officers urged Grant to pierce Petersburg's inner lines that afternoon, but Grant argued that Lee would evacuate the city that night, sparing them any need for further bloodshed. Sheridan had choked off the last railroad into Petersburg, making Confederate survival there impossible. True to Grant's prediction, the Confederate army stole westward at nightfall, and Grant issued orders to overrun the town at dawn the next day. Once Lee decided to retreat from Petersburg, he wired Jefferson Davis and advised him to leave Richmond at once. The messenger who bore this telegram crept down the aisle of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Richmond and handed it to Davis, who turned deathly pale, bolted from his pew, and left. As alarmed whispers spread through the church, government officials fled, and soon the whole congregation poured into the street where pandemonium broke loose. People scurried about frantically, desperate to desert the town. At the train station, officials scrambled to load treasury gold and government archives onto trains bound for Danville. The cabinet rode off by 2 in the afternoon. People clambered onto roofs of overloaded trains or clung feverishly to their sides. Determined to deny the Yankees anything of value, residents set ablaze cotton and tobacco, and flames enfolded the town by nightfall. In the early morning of April 3rd, retreating Confederate troops exploded ordnance depots, causing thousands of shells to burst until a vast column of dense black smoke shot into the air. Several bright jets of flame augured the breaking forth of that terrible conflagration which subsequently swept across the heart of the city, wrote a British correspondent. Shattered glass spilled across sidewalks. By the time Yankee troops under Godfrey Weitzel arrived at 8:15 the next morning, their first order of business was to douse towering sheets of flame that had burned hundreds of buildings in what came to be known as the Burnt District. In South Carolina, Mary Chestnut penned an epitaph for the Confederacy. "Everything is lost in Richmond, even our archives. Blue-black is our horizon." Grant was hardly surprised that Lee had abandoned Richmond. His only surprise was that he had held it for so long at such dear cost. In later years, he expounded on Lee's error in holding on to Richmond. "After I crossed the James, the holding of Richmond was a mistake. Lee sacrificed his judgment as a soldier to his duty as a citizen and the leader of the South. I think Lee deserves honor for that, for if he had left Richmond when Sherman invaded Georgia, it would have given us another year of war." As word of the Petersburg and Richmond surrenders spread to northern cities, the joy was as profound as the pent-up misery of the war had been deep. In Washington, crowds filled the streets with raucous people laughing and bellowing hurrahs. Philadelphia residents broke out flags and flapped them deliriously. Even in the sober precincts of Wall Street, George Templeton Strong found a euphoria that transformed pure strangers into instant comrades. "I walked about on the outskirts of the crowd, shaking hands with everybody, congratulating and being congratulated by scores of men I hardly know, even by sight." On the morning of April 3rd, Grant entered Petersburg and, with bullets still ricocheting off walls, took shelter with Meade in a deserted brick house at 21 Market Street that offered cover from enemy fire. Members of the town council, old men in homespun butternut clothing, bearing an improvised flag of truce that looked suspiciously like a dirty linen tablecloth, said one journalist, surrendered to the new authorities. In the distance, Grant discerned the Confederate army escaping across a bridge over the Appomattox River. He deliberately refrained from bringing up artillery to mow it down. "At all events, I had not the heart to turn the artillery upon such a mass of defeated and fleeing men," he explained, "and I hoped to capture them soon." Instead of trailing Lee's army, Grant preferred to let them withdraw and then race ahead of them, obstructing their access to remaining food supplies in western Virginia and blocking their access to Johnston in North Carolina. Few white residents poked their heads out of doors, while small knots of blacks rejoiced at their Union liberators. As Grant sat on the porch of the house, curious white pedestrians studied the man who had been their constant nemesis and now suddenly turned up in their midst. Taking up Grant's offer, Lincoln, with Tad in tow, slowly made his way on horseback to Petersburg, garbed in a black suit, a silk hat, and trousers that inched up his legs as he rode. Despite anguished concerns about his personal safety, he reassured Stanton, "I will take care of myself." He traversed battlefields covered with mutilated, bloated bodies, and William Crook noted that the president looked upon one man with a bullet hole through his forehead and another with both arms shot away. As Lincoln mused on these dreadful visions, his face settled into its old lines of sadness. On the fringes of Petersburg, Robert Lincoln met his father with horses and a cavalry escort, and the retinue proceeded through eerily deserted streets, passing dozens of skeletal houses with gaping holes blown through their walls. When they reached the brick house where Grant awaited them, The general-in-chief descended the stairs to greet the president. A beaming Lincoln bounded forward, grasping Grant's hand robustly, his joy gushing to the surface. With a droll smile, he declared, "Do you know, General, I have had a sort of sneaking idea for some days that you intended to do something like this?" As they conversed on the porch, neither Lincoln nor Grant knew of Richmond's downfall. In an expansive frame of mind, Lincoln expatiated on his ideas for Southern Reconstruction. Grant felt he could be open with Lincoln about upcoming battle plans. He expressed pleasure that the Eastern Army was defeating Lee. Otherwise, Western congressmen might have lorded it over their Eastern counterparts after the war. Lincoln confessed he had never given the matter much thought, because his anxiety was so great that he did not care where the aid came from, so the work was done. It is interesting to note that the astute Lincoln never weighed this question while the supposedly apolitical Grant volunteered this insight. As the two men chatted, the little yard before them filled with former slaves emancipated by the triumphant troops in blue. Lincoln and these freed people stared at one another in silent wonder. It would have been hard to say which was more surprising, the sudden freedom of the slaves, or the fact that the president who brought forth the Emancipation Proclamation was there to greet them personally in their first hours of freedom. Lincoln and Grant talked for 90 minutes, hoping to hear the momentous news of Richmond's fall, which didn't arrive. When the two parted, Lincoln pumped Grant's hand, wishing him Godspeed and every success. Grant rode off to join Sheridan, Ord, and Meade in hot pursuit of Lee. The last great chase of the Civil War was on. As Grant sped west, he surveyed the wreckage deposited by Lee's fleeing army. Discarded artillery, ammunition, clothing, burned wagons and ambulances. Union forces had taken 12,000 Confederate prisoners, with large numbers of stragglers rounded up everywhere. Grant spent the night at Sutherland Station, where he received word that Richmond had fallen into Weitzel's hands. The surrounding generals reacted with jubilation, one soldier emitting a cry of joy, "Stack your muskets and go home!" True to his nature, Grant showed no emotion, merely saying, "I am sorry I did not get this information before we left the president. However, I suppose he has heard it by this time." The riven portions of Lee's army, pared down to 35,000 men and separated on opposite sides of the Appomattox River, were set to converge at Amelia Courthouse, 35 miles west of Petersburg. The fond hope of these famished men was to find stores of rations awaiting them there. Instead, due to a bureaucratic snafu in Richmond, they came upon ammunition of little value without rested horses to carry it. The day Lee sacrificed in waiting for supplies proved costly. He had planned to move along the railroad tracks toward Danville and merge with the northward-moving army of Joseph Johnston, defeating Sherman before Grant intervened. Once Grant got wind of this, he ordered Sheridan to move west on the railroad with all possible speed, and Meade traced the same route the next morning. By the time Lincoln returned to City Point, he had learned of Richmond's capture, erasing 4 years of inexpressible heartache. "Thank God I have lived to see this," he told Admiral Porter. "It seems to me that I have been dreaming a horrid dream for 4 years, and now the nightmare is gone. I want to see Richmond." Grant had prevailed upon Lincoln to extend his City Point stay, promising that he would soon be able to tour the liberated Confederate capital. Intent upon capturing Lee's army, Grant was never tempted to enter Richmond and play the swaggering conquistador, a piece of symbolism as profound as his upcoming mercy at Appomattox. The historian John Lothrop Motley praised this exemplary restraint. "There is something very sublime to my imagination in the fact that Grant has never yet set his foot in Richmond, and perhaps never will." With poetic justice, black soldiers joined the entrance of Union troops into the ravaged capital on April 3rd. The message wasn't lost on the townspeople. The white citizens felt annoyed that the city should be held mostly by Negro troops, wrote the Rebel War clerk, John Jones. The next day, escorted by Admiral Porter and a mere 10 sailors equipped with carbines, Abraham Lincoln bravely strode Richmond streets, past hundreds of charred, blasted buildings, his steps shadowed by black people who shouted with rapture, as if suddenly beholding the Messiah. One elderly black man exclaimed, "Glory, hallelujah!" and knelt reverently at his feet. Lincoln stood chagrined. "Don't kneel to me," he admonished the man tenderly. "That is not right. You must kneel to God only, and thank him for the liberty you will hereinafter enjoy. I am but God's humble instrument." Lincoln traveled to the Confederate White House. His face, pale and haggard, said one observer, with a serious, dreamy expression, said another, and occupied the chair so recently warmed by Jefferson Davis. During these stirring days, one disaffected spectator was Julia Grant, who felt snubbed by Mary Lincoln and frozen out of her social circle once Ulysses departed. The Lincolns still stayed aboard the River Queen, anchored in the James River, but Julia enjoyed virtually no contact with them, even though she occupied a boat only 100 yards away. "I saw very little of the presidential party now, as Mrs. Lincoln had a good deal of company and seemed to have forgotten us. I felt this deeply and could not understand it, as my regard for the family was not only that of respect, but affection." Her bitter sense of exclusion sharpened after Petersburg and Richmond fell. "All of these places were visited by the president and party, and I, not 100 yards from them, was not invited to join them." Accompanied by other ladies, Julia rolled in a carriage through Richmond's empty streets. Back in her stateroom, she lamented the terrible devastation wrought by the war. "How many homes made desolate, how many hearts broken, how much youth sacrificed." Suddenly she gave vent to tears and realized that she also mourned the vanished way of life that had bred her in Missouri. "Could it be that my visit reminded me of my dear old home in Missouri?" With the war's end in sight, questions emerged as to whether the Confederate leaders should be treated leniently or harshly. While Lincoln seemed inclined toward leniency, Vice President Andrew Johnson, in a speech celebrating Richmond's fall, previewed a more vindictive spirit. When his allusion to Jefferson Davis elicited shouts of, "Hang him! Hang him!" Johnson appeased the bloodthirsty crowd. "Yes, I say, hang him 20 times. He then extended his retributive wrath to include other ringleaders of the rebellion. "When you ask me what I would do, my reply is, I would arrest them, I would try them, I would convict them, and I would hang them. Treason must be made odious." By April 4th, 1865, Grant had decided to give Lee no respite until he knocked out his army and terminated the war. Nothing mattered any longer except tracking down the enemy army and destroying it. Rawlins applauded his boss's fighting spirit, his determination to end the protracted struggle. "I had feared he might not so decide," he told his wife, "but all is well now, and promising early brightness of the national sky." With Sheridan and his cavalry thundering ahead, straining to overtake the enemy, Grant sorted through intelligence reports to figure out the exact route Lee would take from Amelia Courthouse. Grant rode through a disorderly landscape, swarming with rebel deserters, dazed, exhausted men, often sprawled by the roadside next to wounded brethren. "Houses through the country are nearly all used as hospitals for wounded men," he informed Stanton. At noon, Sheridan reported that Lee's army, crossing to the north side of the Appomattox River, seemed to be retreating toward Lynchburg in western Virginia. With the finely honed instinct of a hunter seeking wounded prey, Sheridan wrote to Grant from Jetersville on April 5th, saying Lee was at nearby Amelia Courthouse had nearly exhausted his rations, and the time had come to trounce the enemy. Lee had ordered rations to be brought up from Danville to the railway junction at Farmville, which now beckoned as his last hope for salvation. He had been reduced to headlong flight to secure food and avert outright starvation. By moving aggressively, Sheridan thought he could foil any move Lee made to Farmville. That evening, after a wearisome day in the saddle, Grant received a letter from Sheridan that had profound repercussions. It arrived in an unconventional form, a Union scout, tricked out in Confederate garb to dupe the enemy, held a tinfoil pellet in his mouth with a message wrapped inside. Sheridan entreated Grant, "I wish you were here yourself. I feel confident of capturing the Army of Northern Virginia if we exert ourselves. I see no escape for Lee." As the great drama hastened to its climax, Grant decided to make his headquarters with his advanced troops, and, without pausing for supper, set off with Rawlins and a dozen orderlies to join Sheridan. Even though Sheridan's camp lay 10 miles off, Grant had to traverse hazardous countryside and skirt rebel lines, logging more than 30 miles on horseback. "I remember being challenged by pickets, and sometimes I had great difficulty in getting through the lines. I remember picking my way through the sleeping soldiers, bivouacked in the open field." Around 10 p.m., Grant reached Sheridan's small frame headquarters in Jetersville, where he found aides toiling by candlelight while Sheridan dozed in an elevated loft. When Grant entered, Sheridan climbed down a ladder, "with no clothing but a shirt, pants, and boots," said an observer. After supplying his weary guests with beef, chicken, and coffee, Sheridan again implored Grant to make the supreme push for victory. An intense debate had divided Sheridan and Meade, with Meade wanting to guard Richmond to the east, while Sheridan feared this would facilitate Lee's escape to the west. Sheridan wished to clobber Lee's army now. With his inimitable gusto, he pored over maps and sketched diagrams showing the positions of Lee's columns and how he could capture his entire army. "Lee is in a bad fix," confessed Grant, who tried to tamp down expectations, resisting premature euphoria. "It will be difficult for him to get away." "Damn him," Sheridan spluttered. "He can't get away." Then he let fly a volley of profanities. These words rattled around in Grant's mind. He knew Sheridan would stalk Lee with his usual febrile intensity. "My judgment coincided with Sheridan's," Grant recalled. "I felt we ought to find Lee wherever he was and strike him. The question was not the occupation of Richmond, but the destruction of the army." Accompanied by Sheridan, Grant consulted with an ailing, dyspeptic Meade, arguing the time had come to scrap prudence and stake everything on victory. Reiterating his wartime credo, Grant insisted he did not want to take Richmond, which was only a collection of houses, but grab Robert E. Lee's army, an active force injuring the country. Among other things, Grant hoped to throw his army between Lee and Johnston's army in the Carolinas, isolating both and ruling out any cooperation. "I explained to Meade that we did not want to follow the enemy, we wanted to get ahead of him, and that his orders would allow the enemy to escape." It was now too late for Grant to pretend that Meade made the major decisions for the Army of the Potomac. On the spot, he took out a pencil and handed Meade orders for his entire infantry to move on Amelia Courthouse early the next morning. That night, Lee abandoned his position there and raced to stay ahead of the Union Army, his abject soldiers reduced to pleading for food from spectators lining the route. At the Battle of Sailor's Creek the next day, Sheridan isolated a corps of Confederate infantry under General Richard S. Ewell, shattering a solid quarter of Lee's army. "The enemy, seeing little chance of escape, fought like a tiger at bay," Sheridan wrote. After furious fighting, Sheridan collared 6 rebel generals and 6,000 prisoners. George Armstrong Custer helped to capture and burn hundreds of Confederate wagons. Like disoriented sleepwalkers, Lee's gallant but now spent soldiers could scarcely function any longer, one correspondent telling how hundreds of men dropped from exhaustion and thousands let fall their muskets from inability to carry them any further. These dazed, retreating figures had the extra handicap of having to stop and turn to fire, making them ready targets for Union marksmen. With his army eroded, Lee understood the terrible meaning of the defeat, destined to be the last major engagement between the Army of the Potomac and the Army of Northern Virginia. As he sat astride Traveler, watching in horror as his noble band of soldiers broke down into a chaotic rabble, he let forth a poignant lament. "My God, has the army been dissolved?" Even before receiving news from Sailor's Creek, Lincoln had narrowly monitored developments. At noon on April 6th, he summoned Mary and others into a drawing room of the River Queen to regale them with the flow of uplifting bulletins from Grant. Once again, Lincoln seemed to possess limitless energy, shucking off the war's oppressive weight. "His whole appearance, pose, and bearing had marvelously changed," noted Senator James Harlan. "That indescribable sadness had suddenly changed for an equally indescribable expression of serene joy, as if conscious that the great purpose of his life had been attained." When Sheridan rushed off a message to Grant, "If the thing is pressed, I think that Lee will surrender," Lincoln endorsed this audacious declaration. "Let the thing be pressed, A. Lincoln." The latest victory effected a critical transformation in Grant's outlook. Quite unlike Sheridan, he hadn't expected to capture Lee's army in its entirety. Now he had to revise his thinking. Upon reaching Sailor's Creek, he observed prisoners coming in by shoals. "I saw there was no more fighting left in that army." He reflected on a conversation he had with a Virginia doctor named Smith, who relayed a startling pronouncement made by Richard Ewell, now in captivity. Ewell regarded the Confederate cause as so helpless that he thought that for every man that was killed after this in the war, somebody is responsible, and it would be but very little better than murder. Spending the night at Burkeville, Grant decided the time had come to propose to Lee the surrender of his army. By the afternoon of April 7th, riding in light rain, applauded by soldiers as he passed, he lifted his hat and nodded in response. Grant arrived at Farmville and heard the clock ticking down toward the end of the war. "Every moment now is important to us," he warned Meade. Galvanized by the fast-moving situation, Grant traveled without baggage, his clothes soiled from squalid roads. Separated from his headquarters wagons, he didn't even transport a dress sword, making it pure happenstance that he was not grandly apparelled for his rendezvous with Lee 2 days later. In the town hotel, an ample brick building with a wide porch, he set up temporary headquarters. However fine in better days, the dowdy hostelry now appeared almost destitute of furniture, Grant wrote. That morning, Lee had passed through Farmville, where he tried to resuscitate his faltering army with waiting rations. Having abandoned plans to escape south toward Danville and the North Carolina border, he planned to drive west to Appomattox Station, where the next batch of supplies, he prayed, would await him in railway cars. If all went according to plan, he would reach Lynchburg and still more abundant supplies, and maybe vanish into the vast hinterland of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Sheridan intended to make sure Lee never reached Appomattox Station, and wrote Grant with that pledge. At 5 in the afternoon, Grant conferred on the hotel veranda with Generals Ord and John Gibbon. Before they hurried off to assist Sheridan, Grant said in a disarmingly soft-spoken voice, "I have a great mind to summon Lee to surrender." Taking up his dispatch book, he wrote on its thin yellow pages interleaved with carbon sheets. In his usual concise style, he began his letter to Lee. "General, The result of the last week must convince you of the hopelessness of further resistance on the part of the Army of Northern Virginia in this struggle. I feel that it is so, and regard it as my duty to shift from myself the responsibility of any further effusion of blood by asking of you the surrender of that portion of the C.S., Confederate States, Army, known as the Army of Northern Virginia. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, U.S. Grant, Lieutenant General. Riding under a flag of truce, Brigadier General Seth Williams and an orderly disappeared down darkening country lanes to deliver this momentous message to Lee. Awaiting the reply, Grant eased into a chair on the veranda, which afforded him a front-row seat as emboldened soldiers from Wright's Sixth Corps moved by with a crisp, elastic step. It developed into one of the war's more theatrical scenes. The soldiers, who had learned to love Grant, spotted him on the porch and saluted him with exultant cheers as they swung by, crooning John Brown's body. When Grant rose and stood by the banister, puffing his cigar, the ovation swelled in volume. As night fell, a starry sky stood revealed, washed clean by the day's rainfall. The soldiers tramped by in bright moonshine, their movements thrown into silhouette by the powerful glow of bonfires bordering the route. They grabbed sticks, thrust them into the blaze, then strode on with flaming torches, as if participating in a candlelight election parade. The night march had become a grand review, noted Horace Porter, with Grant as the reviewing officer. Grant's message reached Lee around 10 p.m. at a little cottage where he was bedding down for the night. He perused it with a blank face that would have done credit to Grant at his most inscrutable, then handed the sheet to his most reliable deputy, James Longstreet, who instantly vetoed surrender with the admonition, "Not yet." Now a study in contradiction, Lee was convinced the war was hopeless, yet was reluctant to fall on his sword. "I have never believed we could, against the gigantic combination for our subjugation, make good in the long run our independence, unless foreign powers should, directly or indirectly, assist us," he mused aloud to General William Pendleton. A devout believer in the Confederate cause, Lee had braced himself to fight until the last moment. "We had, I was satisfied, sacred principles to maintain and rights to defend, for which we were in duty bound to do our best, even if we perished in the endeavor." The comment belies the notion that Lee fought simply from loyalty to his home state of Virginia, and betokens a more militant attachment to Confederate ideology. Lee sat down and formulated his thoughts to Grant. "General, I have received your note of this date. Though not entertaining the opinion you express of the hopelessness of further resistance on the part of the Army of Northern Virginia, I reciprocate your desire to avoid useless effusion of blood, and therefore, before considering your proposition, ask the terms you will offer on condition of its surrender." A courier galloped off into the night. Grant was resting in his room well after midnight when he was given Lee's response. He wisely chose to sleep on his response. The next morning he sent Lee a delicately worded note that dropped the defiant tone that had earned him the nickname Unconditional Surrender Grant. "General, your note of last evening, in reply to mine of same date, asking the conditions on which I will accept the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia, is just received. In reply, I would say that, peace being my great desire, there is but one condition I insist upon, namely, that the men and officers surrendered shall be disqualified for taking up arms again against the government of the United States until properly exchanged. I will meet you, or will designate officers to meet any officers you may name for the same purpose, at any point agreeable to you, for the purpose of arranging definitely the terms upon which the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia will be received. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, U.S. Grant, Lieutenant General. By April 8th, Grant felt confident enough about the outcome that he assured Stanton he expected to compel Lee's surrender the next day. Far from being exhausted, Sheridan's men operated on the spare reserves of energy armies muster in the last spurts of winning wars. Many of Lee's soldiers, by contrast, who came from the surrounding region, began to dissolve back into the countryside from whence they came. As Northern politicians tingled with expectation, future President Rutherford B. Hayes noted that "the glorious news is coming so fast that I hardly know how to think and feel about it. It is so just that Grant, who is by all odds our man of greatest merit, should get this victory." Still, Grant grappled with tremendous anxiety at this pivotal juncture. Lee was approaching supplies sent by railroad at Appomattox Station, while his own supply base receded uncomfortably in the rear. He figured that he had at most a day to close the contest before he would need to retreat and feed his own army. Lee, in turn, knew that if his army could survive another day, he might penetrate farther west to Lynchburg and find a haven in the Virginia and Tennessee mountains. Grant's morning letter reached Lee after dark when he read it in a roadway by the uncertain glare of a candle held aloft by an aide. He pondered the message with an impassive face before passing it to the aide.
"How would you answer that?" he inquired.
The young man, with southern pride, responded,
"I would answer no such letter."
Lee knew such intransigence would no longer suffice. Under the surface, he had been gripped by turbulent feelings all day, striding about in a black mood. Always in tight control of his emotions, Lee sat down by the road and composed his reply to Grant as he clung to his last shred of dignity.
"I received at a late hour your note of today. In mind of yesterday, I did not intend to propose the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia, but to ask the terms of your proposition. To be frank, I do not think the emergency has arisen to call for the surrender of this army. But as the restoration of peace should be the sole object of all, I desired to know whether your proposals would lead to that end. I cannot therefore meet you with a view to surrender the Army of Northern Virginia, but as far as your proposal may affect the CS, Confederate States, forces under my command and tend to the restoration of peace, I should be pleased to meet you at 10 a.m. tomorrow on the old stage road to Richmond between the picket lines of the two armies."
As Grant awaited the reply, the bottled-up tension inside him had triggered a pounding migraine headache. Settled in a farmhouse for the night, he turned to his usual sovereign remedies, soaking his feet in hot water mixed with mustard and slapping mustard plasters on his wrists and neck. The tormenting headache would not pass. That staff officers banged out tunes on a parlor piano surely aggravated the misery for the tone-deaf Grant. Around midnight, Rawlins brought in Lee's letter, which Grant read aloud.
"It looks as if Lee still means to fight," he commented, regretting his foe's obstinacy. "I will reply in the morning."
A heated exchange ensued with Rawlins, who, uncompromising as ever, blamed Lee for shifting the negotiating ground from outright surrender to peace talks.
"No, sir, no, sir," he declared hotly. "Why, it is a positive insult, an attempt in an underhanded way to change the whole terms of the correspondence."
Grant interpreted Lee's statement more charitably, not simply from the standpoint of military advantage, but from human sympathy for what his chastened opponent must be feeling.
"It amounts to the same thing, Rawlins," Grant explained. "He is only trying to be let down easy."
He had no doubt of prevailing in his upcoming encounter with Lee.
"If I meet Lee, he will surrender before I leave."
Rawlins reminded Grant that Lincoln and Stanton had delegated no power to him to arrange terms of peace.
"Your business is to capture or destroy Lee's army."
Perhaps disturbed by this, or else tormented by his headache, Grant, usually an excellent sleeper, managed only a few fitful hours of rest. When Horace Porter checked on him at 4 a.m., he discovered an empty room, finding Grant instead pacing up and down in the yard, holding both hands to his head. Upon inquiring how he felt, he replied that he had had very little sleep and was still suffering the most excruciating pain. Once again, an agonizing headache manifested the extraordinary stress under which Grant labored. The next morning, Palm Sunday, was unseasonably cold and damp. After downing coffee at Meade's headquarters, Grant sent Lee a note that spurned his proposed meeting and yielded no concessions. It did, however, exhibit a softer, more personal side. "General, your note of yesterday is received. As I have no authority to treat on the subject of peace, the meeting proposed for 10 a.m. today could lead to no good. I will state, however, General, that I am equally anxious for peace with yourself, and the whole North entertains the same feeling. The terms upon which peace can be had are well understood. By the South laying down their arms, they will hasten that most desirable event, save thousands of lives and hundreds of millions of property not yet destroyed. Sincerely hoping that all our difficulties may be settled without the loss of another life, I subscribe myself very respectfully, your obedient servant, U.S. Grant, Lieutenant General." When this letter reached Lee, he was in the proper frame of mind to receive it. Sheridan's cavalry had outraced him to the Appomattox depot, capturing four railroad cars, Lee's last hope for subsistence, while the Union Army stood astride the westward route by which he planned to escape. Rebel soldiers were stuck fast in a thicket of Union bayonets. Although they tried one last time to escape the deadly trap, they were badly outnumbered and saw resistance as futile. When one officer suggested to Lee that his army should disband and soldier on as guerrillas, he spiked such dangerous thinking, noting that guerrillas would become mere bands of marauders, and the enemy's cavalry would pursue them and overrun many sections they may never otherwise have occasion to visit. We would bring on a state of affairs it would take the country years to recover from. With his letter sent, Grant mounted Cincinnati and trotted west to Sheridan, who had captured Appomattox Station. Bypassing Lee's army, Grant took a long roundabout route along boggy lanes that spattered his already grimy garments. Toward noon, his progress was halted when a high-spirited officer from Meade's staff galloped toward him, flapping his hat wildly and brandishing a sealed letter, one of the most consequential in American history. Grant broke it open and mutely weighed its meaning. "There was no more expression in Grant's countenance than in a last year's bird nest," observed a journalist. "It was that of a sphinx." Allowing himself the barest trace of a smile, Grant requested that Rawlins read it aloud. As he complied, his eyes flashed and his voice resonated with solemn emotion. "I sent a communication to you today from the picket line whither I had gone in hopes of meeting you in pursuance of the request contained in my letter of yesterday. Major General Meade informs me that it would probably expedite matters to send a duplicate through some other part of your lines. I therefore request an interview, at such time and place as you may designate, to discuss the terms of the surrender of this army in accordance with your offer to have such an interview contained in your letter of yesterday." Now admitting that surrender was the crux of the matter, Lee had capitulated. Grant's headache vanished the instant he set eyes on these words, and he couldn't resist gently ribbing Rawlins. "Well, how do you think that will do?" he inquired of his petulant friend. "I think that will do," Rawlins allowed happily. Only one staff officer openly rejoiced at the extraordinary news. Celebration seemed cheap and tasteless after so many years of epic bloodshed. Sitting down on a grassy slope by the roadside, Grant composed a letter to Lee that struck a conciliatory note, agreeing to meet him at any place he proposed. Orville Babcock delivered it under a flag of truce and found Lee leaning against an apple tree, his feet in the road, chatting with Longstreet beyond Appomattox Courthouse. Based on his long-standing relationship with Grant, Longstreet persuaded a skeptical Lee that his old friend would behave honorably at any parley and not inflict humiliating conditions. After replying to Lee, Grant hurried to meet Sheridan, who was eager to thrash the Confederate Army into final submission. The impetuous Sheridan had been disappointed when a messenger, white flag in tow, announced Lee's surrender. "Damn them," Sheridan blurted out. "I wish they had held out an hour longer, and I would have whipped hell out of them." Grabbing his gloved hand, he swore, "I've got 'em like that." Grant never made such boasts, nor did he revel in a bloodthirsty desire for vengeance. In chatting with Grant, Sheridan dismissed Lee's talk of surrender as a patent ruse. He was, Grant recalled, anxious and suspicious about the whole business, fear there might be a plan to escape, that he had Lee at his feet and wanted to end the business by going in and forcing an absolute surrender by capture. In fact, he had his troops ready for such an assault when Lee's white flag came within his lines. To his credit, Grant conquered any feelings of revenge, and knowing that Lee's overture was genuine, acted on that assumption. With the Confederate Army bivouacked in a nearby valley, Sheridan directed Grant to a brick house on the outskirts of Appomattox Courthouse, where Lee awaited him. It was owned by Wilmer McLean, who had owned a house at Bull Run, damaged during the first battle there. He had fled to the sleepy hamlet of Appomattox Courthouse, hoping to escape further hostilities, and would now claim the odd distinction of witnessing the beginning of the Civil War in his backyard and its ending in his parlor. Approaching the historic rendezvous, Grant was painfully aware of how poorly costumed he was to enact this lofty scene. His slovenly appearance had come about merely from being detached from his headquarters wagon. He had no inkling that later historians might be charmed by his outfit or assume that his mud-caked clothes made a political statement. Quite simply, Grant hadn't expected to meet Lee this soon. "I had an old suit on, without my sword and without any distinguishing mark of rank except the shoulder straps of a lieutenant general on a woolen blouse. I was afraid Lee might think I meant to show him studied discourtesy by so coming. At least I thought so." Later asked what was uppermost in his mind at this sublime moment, a sheepish Grant said prosaically, "My dirty boots and wearing no sword." Grant, now 42, had no trace of gray in his dark brown hair. Nevertheless, his beard was fuller than at the start of the war, his face broader, and the bags heavier beneath his eyes, their somber expression bordering on depression. So earthy was his appearance that one officer said with a laugh that he looked like a fly on a shoulder of beef. However self-conscious Grant may have been about his appearance, he projected authority as he approached the McLean house. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, a hero of Gettysburg, was awestruck as Grant trotted by. "Slouched hat without cord, common soldier's blouse unbuttoned, on which, however, the four stars, high boots, mud-splashed to the top, trousers tucked inside, no sword but the sword hand deep in the pocket, sitting his saddle with the ease of a born master, taking no notice of anything, all his faculties gathered into intense thought and mighty calm. He seemed greater than I had ever seen him, a look as of another world about him. No wonder I forgot altogether to salute him. Anything like that would have been too little." He rode on to meet Lee at the courthouse. Lee dreaded the encounter and only submitted when informed that Sheridan had checkmated his army. "Then there is nothing left for me to do but go and see General Grant," he concluded wearily, "and I would rather die a thousand deaths." as befit a man about to step onto the brightly lit stage of history. Lee startled his officers by appearing in a spotless gray uniform, buttoned tightly to the throat. At 58, he still cut a tall, erect, and imposing figure. Every garment he wore had been chosen with extreme care, the intricately wrought dress sword with the gilded hilt, long embroidered buckskin gauntlets, silk sash fitted around his waist, and high boots with an ornamental design of red silk, set off by prominent spurs. When his officers questioned him about this magnificent display, Lee confided, "I have probably to be General Grant's prisoner, and thought I must make my best appearance." Longstreet saw Lee's ceremonial glitter as so much emotional armor. At first approach, his compact figure appeared as a man in the flush vigor of 40 summers, but as I drew near, the handsome apparel and brave bearing failed to conceal his profound depression. Another spectator noted how Lee's hair and beard had grown as white and fair as a woman's. There was a Roman severity, a patrician air of rectitude about Robert E. Lee, and at Appomattox Courthouse he was determined to look the victor, even if he could not be one. Appomattox Courthouse consisted of a single street or two of straggling houses. When Grant arrived at the brick McLean House around 1:30 p.m., the blue and gray armies faced off uneasily outside of town, set to resume hostilities the second talks failed. Nothing outwardly marked the house as the venue for talks, except that Traveler and another horse munched grass in the front yard. Having dismounted, Grant marched up the wooden steps, crossed the veranda, then entered the front hallway alone. Lee, who was waiting, sat in a small front room with a single aide, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Marshall. Mildly irritated by the delay, Lee rose to greet Grant, shook hands civilly, and ushered him into the room. A stiff, unbending dignity about the unsmiling Lee threw into relief Grant's down-to-earth nature. Pulling off his tattered dark yellow gloves and noting Lee's spruce appearance, Grant apologized for his rough garb. As he appraised the Union general, Marshall thought he looked as though he had had a pretty hard time. Perhaps with mild embarrassment, Lee explained that his new uniform had been sent by some Baltimore admirers and was the only one he had available for the occasion. Because Grant had left his entourage outside, Orville Babcock went out and invited Ord, Sheridan, Rawlins, and other generals into the parlor. They shuffled discreetly into the room. Very much as people enter a sick chamber where they expect to find the patient dangerously ill, one noted. The officers then withdrew as they awaited an agreement. With a large fireplace, two small tables, a wicker armchair, and a leather swivel chair, the McLean parlor was cramped but adequate for negotiations. Characteristically, Grant tried to exchange pleasantries with Lee, who sat there with Olympian gravity. In a slightly fumbling manner, Grant said deferentially, "I met you once before, General Lee, while we were serving in Mexico when you came over from General Scott's headquarters to visit Garland's brigade, to which I then belonged. I have always remembered your appearance, and I think I should have recognized you anywhere." 15 years his senior, Lee didn't bother to pretend that he recalled Grant. "Yes, I know I met you on that occasion, and I have often thought of it, and tried to recollect how you looked, but I have never been able to recall a single feature." The comment surely reminded both men of their highly unequal ranks in Mexico, a difference in status equalized by subsequent events. On the surface, their conversation seemed amiable, but Grant was perceptive enough to discern that Lee struggled with strong feelings behind a mask of cordiality. As he observed in an eloquent passage of his memoirs notable for its empathy, "What General Lee's feelings were, I do not know. As he was a man of much dignity, with an impassible face, It was impossible to say whether he felt inwardly glad that the end had finally come, or felt sad over the result and was too manly to show it. Whatever his feelings, they were entirely concealed from my observation. But my own feelings, which had been quite jubilant on the receipt of his letter, were sad and depressed. I felt like anything rather than rejoicing at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever fought, and one for which there was the least excuse. The tone of Grant's reminiscence confirmed the Duke of Wellington's adage that, "Next to a battle lost, there is no spectacle more melancholy than a battle won." Doubtless, with some exaggeration, Grant claimed, "Our conversation grew so pleasant that I almost forgot the object of our meeting." While Grant tried gamely to converse about friends and old times, Lee seemed to find socializing unendurable under the circumstances and resolutely resisted any show of surface camaraderie. What preyed on his mind were the exact terms of surrender. He cut short small talk in a slightly brusque manner. "I suppose, General Grant," he interrupted, "that the object of our present meeting is fully understood. I asked to see you to ascertain upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Fully prepared, Grant said both officers and men would be paroled and disqualified from taking up arms again until properly exchanged, and all arms, ammunition, and supplies were to be delivered up as captured property. Lee nodded in agreement. "Those are about the conditions which I expected would be proposed." Grant added his fond hope that such terms would lead to a general suspension of hostilities and be the means of preventing any further loss of life. Lee bowed his head in approval. When Grant sought to digress, dwelling on the prospect of peace, Lee firmly steered him back to business. Clearly, he didn't care to prolong this torture. "I presume, General Grant, we have both carefully considered the proper steps to be taken, and I would suggest that you commit to writing the terms you have proposed so that they may be formally acted upon." "Very well," Grant responded. "I will write them out." Chewing a cigar, writing fluently, Grant drafted the surrender terms on a small, oval wooden table, while Lee sat at a squarish, marble-topped table. With no premeditated formula, Grant trusted to the moment's inspiration. Wreathed in cigar smoke, he scribbled the terms rapidly in a manifold order book that enabled him to make 3 copies. Using magnanimous language, he began his transformation from scourge of the South to its unlikely champion. "The arms, artillery, and public property to be parked and stacked and turned over to the officer appointed by me to receive them. This done, each officer and man will be allowed to return to their homes, not to be disturbed by United States authority so long as they observe their parole and the laws in force where they may reside." This last sentence was significant, making Southern soldiers immune from treason prosecutions and setting the stage for post-war reconciliation, or so it was hoped. Afraid Lee would become a martyr and his sword a holy relic, Grant made a point of not asking Lee to surrender his sword. He also didn't care to humiliate him. Finally, Grant omitted the noxious words "unconditional surrender," lest they grate on Lee's proud sensibility. With no tinge of malice, Grant's words breathed a spirit of charity reminiscent of Lincoln's 2nd inaugural address. When he finished writing, Lee cleared the small table before him, wiped his steel spectacles, crossed his legs, and reviewed the language with close scrutiny, asking for only minor revisions. With special delight, he saw that officers would be allowed to save face by retaining their sidearms and horses, and could return home to resume their lives unmolested. With quiet fervor, he said this would have a most happy effect, and accepted the terms, Grant recalled. "I handed over my penciled memorandum to an aide to put into ink, and we resumed our conversation about old times and friends in the armies. Lee seemed hugely relieved. When Grant asked if the terms were satisfactory, he answered,
"Yes. I am bound to be satisfied with anything you offer. It is more than I expected."
The business concluded, Grant brought in his staff officers, but Lee only deigned to engage in conversation with General Seth Williams, his former adjutant when he was West Point superintendent. Apart from this exchange, Horace Porter wrote, "Lee was in no mood for pleasantries, and he did not unbend or even relax the fixed sternness of his features." At first, Grant assigned Theodore Bowers to prepare a fair copy of the surrender agreement, while Marshall drew up an acceptance letter for Lee to sign. Because Bowers' hand quivered nervously and he botched three or four sheets, Grant reassigned the task to his Senecan aide, Eli Parker. When introduced to the swarthy Parker, Lee blushed deeply, eyeing tensely his complexion. "What was passing in his mind, no one knew," Porter said, "but the natural surmise was that he at first mistook Parker for a Negro and was struck with astonishment to find that the commander of the Union armies had one of that race on his personal staff." Another onlooker thought Lee momentarily offended, since he believed a mulatto had been called on to do the writing as a gratuitous affront. Evidently, Lee relaxed when he realized Parker was a Native American.
"I'm glad to see one real American here," he ventured, shaking his hand,
to which Parker retorted memorably, "We are all Americans." The terms of surrender settled. Lee alluded to his hungry army, which had subsisted for days on parched corn, and asked for food and forage for it. Unhesitatingly, Grant consented to provide rations and wondered how many were needed, to which Lee replied, "About 25,000. Grant directed Lee to send his commissary and quartermaster to Appomattox Station, where they could gather plentiful stocks of beef, salt, hardtack, coffee, and sugar.
"I think it will be ample," said Lee,
touched by Grant's generosity,
"and it will be a great relief, I assure you."
M.R. Morgan, Grant's commissary chief, later commented, "Were such terms ever before given by a conqueror to a defeated foe?" Grant showed genuine compassion for the Confederate soldiers, saying he assumed most were farmers and wanted to plant crops to tide them over during the winter. To this end, he issued a directive that rebel soldiers who owned their horses or mules should be allowed to take them home. "This will have the best possible effect upon the men," Lee said. "It will be very gratifying, and will do much toward conciliating our people." The afternoon fast approached 4 o'clock when the final documents were signed, and Lee and Marshall strode onto the porch. The bright lamp of the Confederacy was now nearly extinguished. For all intents and purposes, the war had ended, although Johnston's army in North Carolina, Richard Taylor's in Alabama, and Edmund Kirby Smith's in Texas remained at large. During the encounter, Lee had maintained his marble composure, but as he waited for Traveler to be bridled, he gazed wistfully toward his army and gave way to emotion. Horace Porter registered the lone gesture that disclosed his unspoken despair. "He thrice smote the palm of his left hand slowly with his right fist in an absent sort of way, seemed not to see the group of Union officers in the yard, who rose respectfully at his approach, and appeared unaware of everything about him." Only Traveler's approach snapped him from this trance. When Lee sat up straight in the saddle, Grant descended the front steps and lifted his hat in homage to his vanquished foe, as did other Union officers. In response, Lee tipped his hat and rode off slowly toward his army, while a Pennsylvania regimental band across the way played Auld Lang Syne. The scene was no less solemn when he reached his soldiers, who crowded the wayside, doffing their hats in respect, Lee stared fixedly ahead as he passed, and many men called goodbye or stroked affectionately travelers' flanks. When he at last spoke up, Lee simply said, "Men, we have fought through the war together. I have done the best that I could for you." At this, he and his soldiers wept openly. The moment underscored the loving bond Lee had forged with his men. Many of them had assumed Grant would mete out punitive conditions and were pleasantly surprised. As one said, "The favorable and entirely unexpected terms of surrender wonderfully restored our souls." Grant's handling of his own soldiers was equally sensitive. Once Lee was out of earshot, the Union Army surrendered to jubilation. In marked contrast to Grant, George Meade went wild with exultation, galloping hatless through his camp, shouting madly, "It's all over, boys! Lee's surrendered! It's all over!" Everything not nailed down was twirled in the air. Such a celebration was anathema to Grant, who stopped his artillery from firing a 100-gun salute. After the war, afraid that the North would seem to be bragging about the South's downfall, he even objected to a painting being placed in the Capitol that depicted Lee's surrender. He now reminded his army that the rebels had been restored as their countrymen. Thanks to this, the unseemly rejoicing was stopped, replaced by stunned silence. To prevent scuffles that might upset a conciliatory mood, Grant heeded Lee's request that the two armies be kept apart. Some fraternizing ensued between officers, and old feelings of camaraderie suddenly welled up. The most memorable came when the tall, hirsute James Longstreet shuffled into the McLean household. As soon as Grant saw his old pal, he sprang to his feet, shook his hand, offered him a cigar, and invited him to play Brag, the card game they had enjoyed before the war. As Longstreet told a reporter, he was bowled over by Grant's generous spirit. "Great God," thought I to myself, "how my heart swells out to such a magnanimous touch of humanity. Why do men fight who are born to be brothers?" His whole greeting and conduct toward us was as though nothing had ever happened to mar our pleasant relations. Grant's courtesy at Appomattox became engraved in national memory, offering hope after years of unspeakable bloodshed that peace, civility, and fraternal relations would be restored. It was a fleeting, if in many ways doomed, hope, which may be why it has had such staying power in the American imagination. Although Grant would do everything in his power to make it happen, the promised era of post-war forgiveness and tranquility never truly came to fruition. For the South, surrendering was one thing, but acceptance of post-war African-American citizenship and voting rights would be quite another. Whatever his reservations about Lee as a general, Grant applauded his manly course and bearing at Appomattox. Had Lee resisted surrender and encouraged his army to wage guerrilla warfare, it would have spawned infinite trouble, Grant believed. Such was Lee's unrivaled stature that his acceptance of defeat reconciled many diehard rebels to follow his example. At the same time, it was Grant who set the stage for Lee's high-minded behavior by treating him tactfully, refusing to humiliate him, and granting him generous terms that allowed him to save face in defeat. Once Lee had disappeared, Grant's officers stooped to a rapacious frenzy as they snapped up every conceivable memento of the meeting. Wilmer McLean pocketed $20 from Sheridan for the table on which Grant composed the surrender agreement. The next day, Sheridan gave it as a gift to Libby Custer, wife of George Armstrong Custer, who, legend says, flew off with the prize on horseback. General Ord paid $40 for Lee's table and later tried to give it as a gift to Julia Grant, who diplomatically redirected it to Mrs. Ord. In retrospect, Wilmer McLean forfeited his treasures at bargain prices, and his family claimed that Union officers ransacked the house for souvenirs without paying compensation. One journalist left a vignette of this crazed hunt for sacred relics.
Cane-bottomed chairs were ruthlessly cut to pieces. Haircloth upholstery was cut from chairs, and sofas was also cut into strips and patches and carried away. The episode presaged a post-war rapacity that would supersede the noble sentiments enunciated at Appomattox. Strangely absent-minded, Grant forgot to notify Washington of Lee's surrender and had to be prodded by his staff. At 4:30 p.m., he stopped by the roadside, sat down on a boulder, and wrote a message to Stanton that was singularly devoid of self-congratulation. "General Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia this afternoon on terms proposed by myself. The accompanying additional correspondence will show the conditions fully." Stanton replied with fervor, "Thanks be to Almighty God for the great victory with which he has this day crowned you and the gallant army under your command." The previous day, Abraham Lincoln had left City Point for Washington. Prior to departing, he had unexpectedly requested the military band aboard the River Queen to play Dixie. "That tune is now federal property," he declared, adding it was good to show the rebels that, with us in power, they would be free to hear it again. Back in the Capitol, Lincoln spent the night of April 9th commiserating with William Seward, who had been badly mauled in a carriage accident. Lincoln lay beside him on the bed, delighting him with tales of Grant's victories. "I think we are near the end at last," he concluded. Later, at the White House, as the president prepared for bed, Stanton materialized, waving Grant's telegram, and Lincoln embraced him with undisguised joy. Elated by the generous Appomattox agreement, Lincoln kept saying, "Good! All right!" and "Exactly the thing!" in happy appreciation. As Lincoln went to inform Mary, Stanton rushed to Seward's house with the electrifying news. "Don't try to speak," Stanton told him. "You have made me cry for the first time in my life," came Seward's heartfelt response. Then, on the misty evening of April 11th, with buildings brightly lit throughout the Capitol, Washingtonians took to the streets to celebrate. On the north portico of the White House, Lincoln appeared at his favorite window, and "men fairly yelled with delight," reported Noah Brooks, "and tossed up their hats and screamed like mad." Hundreds of enthusiastic citizens gathered to sing to Lincoln and applaud Lee's surrender. Lincoln again requested Dixie and proposed, "Three cheers for General Grant and the officers and men under him." Standing in a candle-lit glow, Lincoln, in his last public speech, touched on the fraught issue of Reconstruction in the seceded states, a word that connoted sweeping changes ahead for the Southern social order. The Union Army, he noted, would likely linger in the South for an extended period to deal with disorganized and discordant elements, a prospect that would define Grant's career for many years. At a time when only 6 northern states granted blacks the right to vote, Lincoln expressed partial support for black suffrage. "I would myself prefer that the vote were now conferred on the very intelligent and on those who serve our cause as soldiers." These words buzzed angrily in the brain of one spectator, John Wilkes Booth, who supposedly snarled, "That means nigger citizenship. Now, by God, I'll put him through. That is the last speech he will ever make." Julia Grant long remembered the moment at City Point when a breathless telegraph operator handed her news of Lee's surrender. The James River was packed with passenger boats, and the atmosphere grew festive as the information reached them. These boats drew alongside Julia's steamer, and people came aboard to congratulate me and to tell me that General Grant would certainly be the next president. Later on, Julia stoutly supported her husband's presidential ambitions, but at this moment she derived no joy from the possibility, preferring to savor his new renown as chief of this great and victorious army. Around the campfire on April 9th, Grant expressed cautious optimism that the remaining Confederate commanders would soon lay down their arms.
While his staff officers thought he might want to see the army he had defeated, he refused to lord it over them and planned to head to Washington. It was a measure of his humility that, instead of seeking to exploit his army's strength, he wished to demobilize it and end weapons purchases as soon as possible. Having defeated the Army of Northern Virginia, he felt a solicitude for its well-being, and years later admitted to a young Virginian that Lee's army came to hold a place in his heart second only to the paternal care he harbored for his own men.
"Curious sort of feeling, isn't it?" he remarked with wonderment.
On the rainy morning of April 10th, Grant rode out to meet Lee a second time, bringing a bugler and staff officer waving a white flag. On a small hillside beside the road, he and Lee held a parley alone on horseback, while their staff officers, in a most beautiful semicircle, said Parker, kept a respectful distance. The two men behaved with impeccable courtesy, each lifting his hat to the other. They spoke frankly. Lee claimed the war had reduced him to poverty. Grant's main concern was that Lee should exert his moral authority to bring the war to a speedy conclusion, inducing other commanders to relinquish their weapons. Lee endorsed the need to pacify the country and bring the South back into the Union fold. At heart, he asserted, he had always been a Union man and blamed extremist politicians for bringing on the war. He contended that Southerners stood resigned to the end of slavery. Despite these encouraging generalities, Lee balked at specifics. As Grant recollected, General Lee said that his campaign in Virginia was the last organized resistance which the South was capable of making, that I might have to march a good deal and encounter isolated commands here and there, but there was no longer an army which could make a stand. I told Lee that this fact only made his responsibility greater, and any further war would be a crime. While conceding that the war had ended, Lee insisted he couldn't undertake helpful measures without consulting Jefferson Davis, now a fugitive from justice. Grant regretted Lee's inability to break free from his benighted leader. I saw that the Confederacy had gone beyond the reach of President Davis, and that there was nothing that could be done except what Lee could do to benefit the Southern people. When Grant urged Lee to go and speak directly with President Lincoln, Lee again invoked the need to confer with Davis, missing a historic opportunity. After 30 minutes of discussion, Grant and Lee reenacted the courtly ceremony of lifting their hats to each other, and Lee rode off to bid farewell to his army. A couple of days later, after surrendering their arms and folding their colors, the Army of Northern Virginia dispersed in a peaceful manner that demonstrated the wisdom of Grant's clemency. Led by Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, the soldiers in blue lifted rifles to their shoulders in a respectful gesture that touched Southern hearts. Grant allowed the defeated men to ride home free of charge on government transportation and military railroads. After parting with Lee, Grant relaxed on the McLean porch before proceeding to City Point, the first stop on his journey to Washington. He traveled slowly east on a special train that was repeatedly detained by derailed cars and other somber vestiges of war. He didn't reach City Point until the next morning, when he sprinted up to Julia's stateroom and breakfasted with her aboard the steamer. Someone inquired whether Grant planned to visit Richmond, and Julia urged him to do so, but he showed, as always, exquisite sensitivity to the psychology of a defeated people.
"Hush, Julia," he responded, "do not say another word on this subject. I would not distress these people. They are feeling their defeat bitterly, and you would not add to it by witnessing their despair, would you?"
It was the observation of a man who had known terrible shame in his own life and understood the extreme need for self-respect at moments of failure. Grant had grown immeasurably during the war and now possessed a broader understanding of people and politics than his earlier provincial life had ever allowed. One adjutant disagreed.
All through the war, I never noticed him change at all, except to become a little sadder. He felt a terrible responsibility, and he expressed it in his face, in every feature. It was remarkable that Grant had borne so much responsibility for 4 years, despite his alcohol problem and amid unbearable stress. The credit must go first to Grant, who managed to keep his demons at bay enough to win the war, but also to Rawlins. Grant's Galena physician, Dr. Edward D. Kitto, noted that Grant had been surrounded by constant temptation and praised his repeated efforts to overcome the desire for strong drink while he was in the army, and his final victory through his own persistency and the encouragement and advice so freely given him by Rawlins. In the war's final days, the country acknowledged an immense debt to Rawlins by making him a brigadier general in the regular army, then a major general by brevet, honors recommended by Grant, who called him an officer who has won more deserved reputation in this war than any other who has acted throughout purely as a staff officer. A certified failure in civilian life, Grant had entered the war with everything to gain and nothing to lose. The erstwhile leather goods clerk from Galena now had more than 1 million men under his command. A new American military power had come into being that could compete with almost any European army. Grant had been the mainspring of the Union effort, imposing order and giving cohesion to far-flung armies. In summarizing his salient qualities, the New York Times foresaw that in future generations, if a great soldier is indomitable in purpose and exhaustless in courage, endurance, and equanimity, if he is free from vanity and pettiness, if he is unpretentious, truthful, frank, constant, generous to friends, magnanimous to foes, and patriotic to the core, of him, it will be said, he is like Grant. The Civil War had been a contest of incomparable ferocity, dwarfing anything in American history. It claimed 750,000 lives, more than the combined total losses in all other wars between the Revolutionary War and the Vietnam War. The historian James M. McPherson has calculated that, as a portion of the total population, the Civil War killed 7 times as many American soldiers as World War II. While the North lost more men in absolute terms, death took a far graver toll in the South, where the population was smaller, with young and old alike indiscriminately conscripted. By the end, more than 1/5 of the Southern white male population had perished. Grant was sobered by the horrifying roster of casualties, saying future generations would look back at the Civil War with almost incredulity that such events could have occurred in a Christian country and in a civilized age. For the rest of his life, Grant had to deal with the charge that he had merely been the lucky beneficiary of superiority in men and resources. He grew touchy on the subject because it addressed the larger question of whether he had crudely consigned young men to their death, winning by overwhelming force. The plain fact was that 6 Union commanders before him had failed, with the same men and materiel, whereas Grant had succeeded. It vexed him that the North denigrated its generals, while Southern generals were idealized. As he remarked bitterly, "The Southern generals were seen as models of chivalry and valor. Our generals were venal, incompetent, coarse. Everything that our opponents did was perfect. Lee was a demigod, Jackson was a demigod, while our generals were brutal butchers." Over the years, Grant adduced many reasons why the South had the advantage in the war, starting with its political unity versus constant Northern divisions. "We had to send troops to suppress riots in New York. We had enemies in our midst. In every Northern state, there was a strong party against the war, always rejoicing over disaster, always voting to paralyze our forces, ready for any concession or surrender." The South, by contrast, could mobilize fully, recruiting all able-bodied men. 4 million slaves had worked the farms, supported the economy, and freed the white population for military service,
at least before they flocked in large numbers to Union lines, and the Confederacy almost always fought on home turf, with all the obvious advantages that entailed for Lee. What Lee thought of Grant as a general is somewhat contradictory. As already mentioned, he later said George McClellan was the foremost Union general, but the Reverend George W. Pepper, a chaplain in Sherman's army, said Lee named Grant as the premier Union general. "Both as a gentleman and as an organizer of victorious war, General Grant has excelled all your most noted soldiers." Another story, printed years later, said Lee was distressed when somebody argued that Grant had merely profited from fortunate circumstances. "Sir," Lee upbraided him, "your opinion is a very poor compliment to me. We all thought Richmond, protected as it was by our splendid fortifications and defended by our army of veterans, could not be taken. Yet Grant turned his face to our capital and never turned it away until we had surrendered. Now, I have carefully searched the military records of both ancient and modern history and have never found Grant's superior as a general." The authenticity of this quote has been questioned. What has never been doubted is Lee's gratitude to Grant for his behavior at Appomattox, which he commended as without a parallel in the history of the civilized world. Grant betrayed only qualified admiration for Lee. Lee was of a slow, conservative nature, without imagination or humor, always the same, with grave dignity. I never could see in his achievements what justifies his reputation. The illusion that nothing but heavy odds beat him will not stand the ultimate light of history. Strangely enough, Grant derided Lee as a desk-bound general, even though Lee was almost invariably engaged in the field. It seemed to bother Grant that Lee was reserved and aloof, while he himself had always kept open house at headquarters, so far as the army was concerned. Perhaps the person who best explained Grant's strategic superiority was Sherman, who stated that while Lee attacked the front porch, Grant would attack the kitchen and bedroom. In his earthy way, Sherman expressed the view that Grant engaged in total warfare that eroded enemy supply lines and infrastructure, while Lee remained tightly focused on the battle at hand, without a long-term strategy for winning the war. For all the endless horrors of that war, Grant believed the country was stronger for having endured it. "We are better off now than we would have been without it, and have made more rapid progress than we otherwise should have made." The country had become more cosmopolitan, its citizens more worldly, its economy more productive, its military more potent. Most important, Union forces had struck a major blow for freedom and equality. Like Lincoln, Grant deemed the war a punishment for national sins that had to come sooner or later in some shape, and probably in blood. 4 million slaves had been emancipated and would shortly receive the right to vote, send their children to public schools, and enjoy the benefits of citizenship, progress that would be savagely resisted. For Grant, the war had validated the basic soundness of American institutions. Before, he noted, monarchical Europe generally believed that our republic was a rope of sand that would part the moment the slightest strain was brought upon it. Now it has shown itself capable of dealing with one of the greatest wars that was ever made, and our people have proven themselves to be the most formidable in war of any nationality. He added the important caveat that the war had been a fearful lesson and should teach us the necessity of avoiding wars in the future.